condition of all that. That kind of action. But to admit, this is it. This is the first step. So, and as I say, I have seen instances of dreams that have taken people back beyond their earliest memories, and they know that that's what's occurring. And they will say, I can't really remember this, but that's definitely what's going on. Now, these dreams, though, if they're personal, or come from the personal unconscious, or what Jung calls the personal unconscious, they don't have any transpersonal or quasi-mythical significance about them. That's what distinguishes them from what he calls archetypal. That doesn't mean that someone else wouldn't be able to understand my dream. Sure, I can tell you my dream, and you can offer me an intelligent interpretation of it. But the meaning is not one that seems to be reflective of the mystery of human living. It's reflective of the history of a given person, yes. But it doesn't have that kind of mythical significance about it. It has a very different emotional tone to it. A mythical tone, where in the symbolism something is being caught that reflects the mystery of human existence as we all experience that mystery. That's what happens in the archetypal symbol. In the archetypal symbol, the mystery of human existence, as we all somehow experience it. And as I relate to you the archetypal dream, you, if you're attentive to story that I'm telling, I'm participating in that sense of mystery that I felt when I had the archetype. You're not simply participating in my own individual history, whether it be a history of suffering or a history of success or whatever. You're participating in a universal human drama in some kind of way. And the archetypal dream will speak in symbols, as I said, that can be understood from one culture to another, from archaic cultures to technologically advanced cultures. In fact, perhaps even more loudly to the archaic cultures, because they're more in touch with that dimension of experience. And in the archetypal dream, the symbols may not at all be taken from my own personal experience. And this is one of the most significant things about the archetypal dream. That the symbol may not come from my experience at all. Jung tells of one of his visits to the United States where he was having his hair cut somewhere in the southern United States by a purebred African, a person of pure African blood, completely illiterate, with no formal education whatsoever. He started telling him his dreams as he was cutting his hair. And the man was experiencing in his dreams symbols that Jung knew from his own education, featured in the Greek mythology, the myth of Ixion transfixed to the sun wheel. The symbol was coming into this man's dreams. And somehow it had something to do with the suffering involved in wholeness. Suffering involved in coming to wholeness. And that symbol, the kind of almost crucifixion type symbol of the suffering, but the sun wheel being a symbol of wholeness, and the suffering leading to wholeness, is somehow releasing itself in that man's dream as a symbol for the same thing that it meant when the Greeks projected the myth of Ixion. It had the same significance in this man's dream. This man, Jung said, the chances of his knowing anything about the myth of Ixion are quite minimal. Of his ever having read about it,
or being instructed about in how many of you have rich. Okay? So the chances of his having picked that up from any kind of formal educational experience or anything like that are very minimal. The symbol is has that power, you see. And that same power was known by the Greeks when they experienced it and told it as they told the story. They told the myth. But the dream, or the symbol, in a sense, is prior to the telling. And the telling is reflective of a prior psychic experience. And it's that kind of thing that led Jung to talk about archetypes. Particularly his discovery that contemporary people, contemporary men and women, will dream symbols without any knowledge of mythical history, history of mythology, will dream symbols that appear in the mythologies of races and cultures quite different than their own. Now, it would not be particularly scientifically significant, for instance, if I dreamt a symbol that appeared in ancient Greek mythology. I mean, it wouldn't be scientifically significant in the sense of talking about a collective unconscious. Why? Because my culture comes out of Greek culture, and I have been educated in Greek mythology, and have probably heard, to a greater or lesser extent, about most of the mythical symbols that appear in Greek mythology. So you couldn't use that as an argument for the dimension of the psyche that Jung was referring to as the collective unconscious. If, however, I dreamt a symbol that was functioning today in the religious practices of the Australian Aborigines, that's the kind of argument that Jung found leading to the notion of the collective unconscious. I have no knowledge whatsoever. I've never read, studied anything about the religious practices of the Australian Aborigines. And if that came into my dream, he's saying this kind of thing does happen at times. And this black barber in South Carolina or Georgia, wherever it was, in one of the instances of it. That's the kind of argument that we use to start talking about the collective unconscious. There is a dimension of psychic symbolism that has a power to express certain realities about the mystery of human existence. And it can express those in symbols that I have no personal background for, as far as the content of the symbol is concerned. There's no personal background that would have taught me about that significance, but all of a sudden it is released as expressive of my participation in the mystery of human existence. This black man's dream of the crucifixion against the sun wheel, you see, is reflective of the suffering that is leading to the integration of his own life. And the symbol is released at that point. That's the kind of argument, the kind of evidence that he used to talk about this distinct level of the psyche, which he called the collective rather than the personal
consciousness. Does Jung see these archetypal symbols as absolutely prior to consciousness? And I don't mean, I mean to the beginning, of consciousness.
I think he's ambiguous on that. There are times when he talks about them as though they were like a Platonic world of forms, except that they're down there rather than up there. So you're down in the unconscious rather than up in some Platonic heaven. There are times when his talk sounds like that. Or that they're preformed, like Kantian categories, that are preformed. And then there are other times when he explicitly says, I don't want you to think of them this way. That they are rather functions of the person's participation in the mystery of existence. And that they are released in that kind of way. But I think there, Jung is this is the clarity on it to a certain extent, or it falls into ambiguity because of the implicit Kantianism of his own philosophical background, which he never really clarified for himself, nor did he ever explicitly take up a position with regard to it. And so there's a tendency to move from Kant's notion of categories in the conceptual order to archetypal symbols in the psychic order, and think of them the same way as Kant thought of the categories. And he tends to do that. So you get there other times when he explicitly says, I don't want you to think of the collective unconscious as some thing down there filled with these things, you see. That's too unsophisticated a way to think about it. In the fourth chapter of Subject and Psyche, I go into that in terms of trying to show that Jung is still ambiguous in his way of talking about it. There are times when he does say that this is almost like a world, you know, a supersensible world of things. And yet, I think he wants to get beyond that point.
Last week or somewhere in there, last time, you spoke in terms of our personal creation of our unconscious by the repressive mechanism. And that somewhere in there you made a passing reference, at least, to some of the difficulties with Jung's description of the unconscious in those terms. It sounds more like the mechanism of creating our own unconscious remains, and it's simply the language that unconscious uses communicate with consciousness that has any reference to a collectivity.
Right.
It's still a very personal set of experiences
right.
that are in on the unconscious.
Right. I agree with that. I think that's the way that's getting much closer to the reality of it. Yeah. Now, independently, however, of the ambiguity with which he may have spoken about it, the reality that he's speaking about, I think, is a genuine thing. The language has So with regard to archetypal symbols, they are not derived from my past or present experience. Or if they are so derived, and I'll give you an example in a moment, if they are derived from my past experience, they function in a way that expresses that mystery of human existence. They don't function just as bringing me back to something in my past. Maternal symbolism is the thing that I'm thinking of here. Maternal symbolism has an archetypal meaning, or it can have an archetypal meaning, and not just be referring to my mother. But the mother can be used by the psyche to reflect, for instance, in a positive way, the nourishing power of life's energies. The psyche can take the personal mother and use her in that symbolic way. Where she takes on a more than purely personal significance. She takes on an archetypal symbolic. Or it can be negative as well, because there are archetypes, as Jung does some work on in Volume 9 of his collected works, of the destructive mother, as well as of the positive mother. That is to say, of the destructive nature of life's energies, as well as of their nourishing energies. But the point is here that the personal reality of the mother appearing in the dream is symbolizing not your own mother, but the energies of life as they nourish, as they do something that perhaps your own mother did, and they nourish you or destroy you. Something personal from your life can take on an archetypal symbol. Okay, so some of the symbols that have archetypal meaning have a personal derivation in your experience, but the way in which they're experienced in the dream is some archetype, so not purely personal. You get the sense of it. Now, this kind of thing is extremely important in terms of the conflict between Freud and Jung. Let's just take the maternal symbolism as an example of that. For Freud, every time, to use the most blatant instance of it. Every time your own mother appears in your dreams, you're being brought back to an unresolved element in the repeatable conflict of infancy.
Particularly every time the personal mother appears in the dreams of a man,
of an adult male, Freud would say, all right, we're back at the step one again, or whatever it was, theory. We're back at the Oedipal conflict, and we're seeing something that's unresolved in the Oedipal conflict at this point. Jung would say, not necessarily so. It may have that meaning. It may be quite different. Jung would say that your memories of your own mother are now being used by the psyche as the best expression of your present development. Positive or negative development. Because your mother is the best symbol the psyche knows for that reality. She has, obviously in every one of us, the mother is psychologically tremendously important. She may be the best symbol to express what's going on right now. But what's going on right now may not be the Oedipal conflict at all. What may be going on right now, for instance, is that the nourishing power of the psyche is available to you. And the psyche may know no better symbol than that than the mother. So the mother will be used to indicate the nourishing power of the psyche. It has nothing to do with the Oedipal conflict. It's really not catching anything about a prior conflict in your life at all. It's just that's the symbolic significance that she's got in your psyche. Thank God for it as it is, and the psyche will use it that way. To say something that doesn't have anything to do with your relationship to your mother in that literal sense of the word. Well, what better symbol can it use than the mother, if in fact that's the way the mother has functioned in the first capacity? As one who gives nourishment, all right? The psyche's got that. These two go together. And the nourishing power of life is available, and the mother is using it. But it's not a reflection of infantilism at all. So, again, Jung's whole dream interpretation is far more nuanced. And he would say, look, to Freud, he said, yeah, some of those dreams are obviously Oedipal. Again, you can't say every time the mother appears, it means that I want sexual union with her and I hate my father and I want to kill him but I'm afraid of him and all that sort of thing. It doesn't always mean that. Is that clear? All right, now, in transpersonal symbolism, there are two levels. Jung failed to realize that there are two quite distinct levels of transpersonal symbolism. There's a level of transpersonal symbolism, or from what he called the collective unconscious. There's a level of transpersonal symbolism that expresses the internal rhythms of the psyche insofar as the psyche is a part of nature. The example that I just gave of the helpful maternal symbol is a good example of that. It's expressive of the internal rhythms of the psyche insofar as the psyche is a part of nature. And it is saying something about the natural development of the person. But it's saying it in language that has an archetypal, cross-cultural, mythical significance, and the power, the emotional power of it, is far more obvious and apparent than the power of purely personal dream symbols. Those are the symbols I want to call archetypal. My language now, changing Jung's meaning on it because I think there are two levels of transpersonal symbols. For by archetypal symbols, then, I mean symbols that are taken from nature and imitate nature. The mother symbol, in the case that I just mentioned, is taken from nature and it imitates nature. The nourishing power of the mother is imitated as the mother is used to symbolize the nourishing power of the psyche. There are other symbols, or there are other uses of symbolism. That reflect the drama of the psyche in relationship to the ultimate meaning of human existence. And that ultimate meaning is determined from beyond nature. In other words, there are uses of transpersonal symbolism that say something about my orientation beyond the whole cosmos, my orientation to God, and my participation in the drama of good and evil, not just my involvement in my own development as a natural process, but my participation in the drama of good and evil, or my being called by God, or my being healed by God. And what happens in these symbols is that the symbol is taken from nature but points to the total transformation of everything under the power of God. It has a significance that can be recognized as eschatological. And the whole sense of that kind of symbolic experience orients me to a mystery that is beyond the whole of nature. So, some of the things that can come into these symbols, I'm calling these anagogic symbols. The word anagogic means pointing beyond or leading beyond. Some of the things, again, that can be involved in such symbols, my participation in the drama of good and evil, my being called by God, my being touched by God, my being healed by God. Something along those lines. But the whole thing is my relationship not to intra-worldly realities, but my relationship to the reality that is beyond the world, some way or another. We call those anagogic. They point beyond the whole of created reality and reflect my relationship to the reality beyond the whole. And it can be in many different ways. They don't simply imitate nature. They have about them that eschatological significance that somehow has something to do with the transformation of nature by grace. And one feels that one is being addressed, directly by a mystery that somehow lies beyond what's within the potentials of the natural world, in some way or another. One is being called to the recognition of that ultimate ground of existence. Now, symbols, the same symbol, this comes up, this Bill is an answer to your earlier question about the water symbolism. The same symbol can be used either archetypally or anagogically at times. And the whole thing is, all right, what is the a sense of the use of that symbol? Am I being related by that symbol to the rest of nature? Okay. Or am I being, is the symbol somehow relating me beyond the whole of nature to the origin and destiny? That's the sense of it. It can be the same symbolic reality. The question is, how is it functioning? I'll give you one example of what I would regard as an anagogic experience, and then next class I'll have several others that will indicate the kind of thing we're talking about. Some of you, if you were in religion and culture last year, I think you probably have heard this. Maybe not. I might have been in this course that old gave it. But it's a dream that a friend had by a friend of mine who told me that I knew to use it. Teaching this material. A person whose life was psychically extremely traumatic. His mother became blatantly, obviously schizophrenic when he was 7 years of age. And she was in and out of mental institutions for most of his childhood and adolescent life. And then finally, she's been living in the home for about the last 10 years, but she's really what they refer to frequently as an ambulatory schizophrenic. She is not living in the same world as the rest of us are in. And I visited the family, and she's, you know, she will stay with you in a conversation for maybe 3 or 4 minutes. And then she's off into her own world, and she's talking to people from that world, and smiling and with them, and back and fighting with them and everything else. But you know, she's not in the same world as I'm in. And it's a very sad thing, and you just get the sense of what that sort of experience can do to the psyche of a child. He's a person who, because of a lot of emotional difficulty, had a lot of difficulty getting through college. He's very bright, but a lot of other things that were in the way. But he finally did. And then went back to his hometown after graduating from college, and for a while was just doing odd jobs and not very happy with any of them, and very much of a sense that his life was never going to lead him anywhere. Not very excited about anything. He came back to the city where I was in, Milwaukee, at the time. This is where he went to college. And came back for one of these. He had just been laid off a job. Came back and he said, well, I'm going to stay a couple of days. Just bum around and so on. Well, a couple of days became 5 days. 5 days became a week became 2 weeks. And finally, he was there a month. And you could see that externally and internally, all kinds of things started to click during that month. Externally, things started to fall into place. In the sense of a possible future educational career opening up to him, which would lead to a job that was quite open-ended in terms of its possibilities and all that. And while all that's going on in the external world, he's having these magnificent psychological experiences every other night. And that sort of thing, all of them point to some kind of major therapeutic process taking place in his own experience. And it's one that has started before he even came. He had anticipatory dreams and so on. For instance, of being able to fish being a symbol of salvation, you know, and said somehow fish were going to be available to him in Milwaukee and that sort of thing. Came back. Well, the whole process culminates with a dream in which he is standing in front of a mirror shaving. And he's shaving with a straight-edged razor, and he shaves over a scar in his face, and there's 68 stitches in it. And this is the first time that he's been able to shave over a scar. The wound is a big one, 68 stitches in your face. It's a big, serious persona wound. It's a serious wound in your social confidence, you know, the face that you set to the world has been wounded badly. But he's able just to shave over it now without it opening. First time to do that. And the sense, and this is not the particularly, he's not a church mouse type of person, he's not a particularly ebullient religiously, ebullient expressive. But there was just nothing. He said, if that's what you mean by being touched by God, I finally know what you're talking about. There's no other way for me to relate to that reality about being. 26 years of my life have reached a turning point at this point. And it came from without. And I am in relationship to a power to heal. So there's the sense of it, the sense of being related to something that is not just nature. It's the sense of being related to a magnificent intervention from beyond nature into life. And then we started doing some possibilities of number symbolism. And I'll just finish off with this to do something that around that imagination. This does, kind of thing doesn't always work, but it did in this particular case. And again, he's the one that just validated enough in the history of literature and this and so on. One is unity. Two is opposition. Or polarity. Three is process. Four is wholeness. And five is the ego getting the first four together. Five is taking up wholeness and moving on with it. And in this particular case, you could have that dream that that's significant as well. That his ego is empowered to take up a wholeness that has been given and move on. It's exactly how I do it. So, at least in this
that sort of thing is. It's the five tools, isn't it, in the gate to take up your bed and walk.
No, I never thought of it.
And the five.
Could be, especially knowing
what finally got it together.
Symbolism and John, yeah.
Five husbands.
Tell David Stanley that.
See what he does. I can't go near any of that with any of these.
I think that this whole thing is going to be helpful for scriptural interpretation. All right, that's it. Again, we have to wait 2 weeks. I have a lot of other archaeological dreams to tell you. But,